Welcome to the Week in 60 Minutes from Spectator TV, recorded on Thursday, December the 3rd. It's been a dramatic week. A vaccine is on its way. It's arriving next week, heralded by a flurry of Johnsonian metaphors. Will it quell Tory backbench anger at multi-tier lockdowns? It's already provoked the government's biggest parliamentary rebellion yet. If it wasn't for Labour abstentions, disgruntled Tory MPs would have overturned even its 80-seat majority. I'll be speaking to their ringleader, the rebel ringleader, former whip, Mark Harper. A new poll put support for Scottish independence at 56%. Is the momentum behind Scottish nationalism now unstoppable? Emily Gray is the Ipsos Mori pollster behind this week's numbers and will be joining the show. And finally, our third segment today, the language of so-called critical race theory. It's permeated many conversations this year, fueling the Black Lives Matter movement, triggering a backlash from some more conservative politicians. But what is critical race theory, and is there anything to learn from it? I'll be asking Trevor Phillips, former chairman of the Equality and Human Rights Commission. Now, before we kick off, a reminder to subscribe to The Spectator's YouTube channel for free. Then you'll never miss a new episode of Spectator TV. Just hit the subscribe button. It's at the bottom right corner. And as always, we make a special thanks to Charles Stanley for supporting this episode of The Week in 60 Minutes. Charles Stanley is one of the UK's leading wealth management firms and one of the oldest companies on the London Stock Exchange. So our first item today, 55 Tory MPs rebelled against the government at a vote on returning England to the three-tier lockdown system. Mark Harper, a former chief whip, he's now the ringleader of the backbench rebels, joins the show shortly. But before that, let's chew over the week's developments with The Spectator's political editor, James Forsyth, our deputy political editor, Katie Balls, and our economics correspondent, Kate Andrews. James, place this rebellion, the Tuesday vote, in context. How significant was it, given that the government wasn't actually defeated?
It is the biggest rebellion of Boris Johnson's premiership. It was a rebellion that was so large that if the opposition parties had not sat on their hands but opposed the government would have lost. It clearly is significant. It's also significant because it's part of a trend. The number of Tory rebels against these COVID measures has been rising consistently. When the Coronavirus Act, which gave the government its emergency powers, was passed in March, it was passed in March without a vote because there was essentially unanimity across the House. When those powers came to be renewed in September, only 7 Tories voted against it. Then 42 Tories voted against the 10 p.m. curfew and various other measures. And you've now seen 53 Tory rebels on this measure. And I think it is quite clear from anyone listening to the debate in the House of Commons, what's been said from the government from the dispatch box, that if this, when this tier system comes back for a vote in the Commons at the end of January, if quite a few places haven't moved down the tiers, if there hasn't been more of an effort made to disaggregate places with low infections from areas of high infection, so for example, splitting off West Kent from those Medway towns or North Somerset from Bristol, then I think the Tory rebellion will be bigger. And I think that the question for Boris Johnson is, you know, how quickly can they get these vaccines rolled out and then approved? And does that help to quell the rebellion? Because I think if the last vote on the tier system is the one at the end of January, it renews it, and then we see a significant easing up in March before a lifting of all the restrictions in April. This period, Boris Johnson will be able to put this period behind him quite quickly with his parliamentary party. But if the vaccine rollout is bumpy, if it takes time, if we end up with restrictions still being in place after Easter and the government having to have several more votes on the tiers, I think these rebellions are just going to keep getting bigger.
Katie, the government obviously had wind of the rebellion and that it was going to be on some scale. We understand that Boris Johnson stood at the division lobby door in the Commons appealing to rebels not to vote. Do we know if that was a plus or a minus for his case?
Well, those around him alleged it was an effective performance from the Prime Minister and one of a series of measures that they put in place throughout the day to reduce the size of the rebellion. For example, before Boris Johnson went, you know, just trying to almost suggest to people as they walked where they where they should go, you had an impromptu Zoom meeting that the Prime Minister called with his chief whip, where Tory MPs at the last minute were invited to tune in, you know, an hour or so before the vote so he could address them. And in that, his message was quite simple. He said, ultimately, unity is really important for the Tory party, for the government, and don't give Labour the satisfaction of seeing a disunited Tory party. And I think that's interesting because some of the Tory rebels want to say, yo, you know, this isn't a party politics. This is a issue which doesn't have long implications for Boris Johnson. You know, it's just coronavirus. But the fact that Boris Johnson made that argument himself about how this would look shows how Number 10 do see this rebellion, which is something which is worrying to Boris Johnson's authority.
Kate, one of the arguments of the rebels is the economic damage that a second lockdown is doing. We know that the British economy bounced back a fair bit in the third quarter after the terrible second quarter, but it was beginning to peter out towards the end of September as more lockdowns came in. Are we able to see yet what the economic damage of what I might call the second lockdown has been?
No, we don't know yet, although there have been some estimates that non-essential retail were losing out on £2 billion a week. There are questions as to whether or not Debenhams, which has fallen under this week, is a result of lockdown, or whether or not that's just a result of a business going under. And as we say in this week's Spectator Leader, that's not necessarily a bad thing. Part of the market process is failure, and Debenhams was in administration in spring last year. It's clearly not just COVID that's affected that business. But the problem is that when we look at business closures right now, we're not looking at any of them in isolation. We're looking at them at a time where you've had extreme restrictions, especially on retail. And it's very difficult to say that this would have naturally happened, or certainly not at this pace. And of course, it's not just shops that are, you know, selling clothes and objects. It's pubs and restaurants as well. It's estimated at the moment that over 50,000 licensed pubs and restaurants may not be reopening, even though we're out of lockdown now, because only 2% of pubs are in tier one areas. So this is a lot of the data that we're going to get in the coming months. And next year, it's thought that's going to be when the hardship really shows itself. Employment peaking at 7.5%, it's estimated, not just by the Office for Budget Responsibility last week, but now by the OECD this week.
James, the Prime Minister has now said there'll be fortnightly reviews of the system, who's in what tier and so on. But is it seriously the intention that there will be major movement of regions between tiers as a result of these reviews, or is it just an attempt to placate the rebels?
So I think when the system was originally announced, the expectation, certainly among government scientific advisors, was that there wouldn't be very much movement because there is this Christmas easing, this 5 days where up to three households be allowed to mix. We know that the scientific advisors think that that is likely to send the case rate up, and therefore that they wanted to keep things as tight as possible in the run-up to that. Now, I think there might be some movement. I think, you know, for example, Greater Manchester, its cases are coming down. It might move from tier three to tier two at that point. Possibly there'll be some attempt to detach some places from urban areas with high levels of infection that appear to have very low levels of infection themselves. But I think the reality is that if these 5 days of Christmas easing have anything like the effect that the scientific advisors expect, we know that people on Sage think that for every 1 day of Christmas easing, you need 5 days of tighter restrictions afterwards to compensate. Then I think it is hard to see that when Parliament, when these reviews take place in January, that they'll be losing lots of places down the tier system. And I think you see another sign of concern with the plan announced today, that university students will return in a staggered fashion, with some not making it back to university until the beginning of February. I think that is because the last thing that the government wants to see is that spike you saw when universities went back in mid-September, combining with the post-festive period increase. Now, the risk of the festive period is obviously that people will travel around the country and so move from low infection areas to high infection areas and back again. And so I think the big question now is, you know, what happens there? And then I think the other massive question, which the Deputy Chief Medical Officer, Jonathan Van Tam, touched on this morning, is when is this Oxford vaccine approved? If the regulator approves that before Christmas, I think that does change things, because that means that the UK can set about a policy of attempting to vaccinate every adult who wants to be vaccinated. And it can set about trying, and it doesn't need to work out precisely who gets it, you know, it doesn't need to ration it. It can just flood the zone with this vaccine. And I think that might enable you to start doing some serious easing late February, early March. And that might help to placate Mark and some of his colleagues, who I think their worry is that these measures will just kind of continue on and on. It'll be like rationing after the war. There won't be a moment when these goes. And I think that's why at his press conference last night, Boris Johnson, who doesn't like disagreeing publicly with his scientists, went out of his way to say that he didn't agree with Van Tam when Van Tam suggested that some of the measures that have been put in place to deal with coronavirus might well stay in place even after people have been vaccinated.
Well, you mentioned Mark Harper. James, he's with us now, one of those backbenchers who rebelled. He was chief whip under David Cameron. That's a job in which you're meant to suppress rebellion. But today he leads the newly formed COVID recovery group. It's a merry band of COVID skeptic Tory MPs, or at least lockdown skeptic Tory MPs. Mark Harper, welcome to Spectator TV. So you're a gamekeeper turned poacher now. What happened?
Well, look, for me, there's a range of people in our group, but for me, primarily, this was about not feeling the government had been as open and transparent with MPs as I think it should have been on two sides. One of them is just about the measures that are being proposed and how effective they're going to be. And from my point of view, is I'm rather disappointed by the level of information we've seen put out about the modelling, about how each of the measures was chosen. So, for example, hospitality. There's very little evidence that there's been significant spread of COVID in hospitality venues. Very few of them have been pinged on track and trace. There's very little academic evidence. There's a little bit now that's been published around ventilation, but the government hasn't engaged with the industry about ventilation. And my argument is, if you've got COVID secure guidelines and you're telling businesses to invest money and they can operate safely, then why can't they operate safely? If you really think they can't operate safely at all, whatever they do, then shut them down, but then you have to compensate them properly. And the problem at the moment, in tier 3 areas, they're shut. Tier 2 areas, they're able to trade, but we're not allowing people to go to them unless you go to people with your household. So there's a real issue there for me about, have we got the measures right? And for me, it's not just about are they too tough, it's are they going to work? And you've just been talking about Christmas. So I have a real concern about whether, does it make sense to tighten things up, relax them at Christmas, potentially have a whole month of restrictions with massive costs? Now, it may be the right thing to do, but I haven't seen any sense of data or information or any sense the government's weighed that up properly. They may have done, but they've not shared that with members of parliament, and I think for this level of issue you do. Then just finally, picking up on Kate's point about the economics, the government's analysis that it published this week was very disappointing. It was some cut and paste work from the OBR. They didn't even share information which we know they've got, that was in the Times, and I know that Times story was true because someone sent me some extracts of those documents, so I know they exist, but they weren't shared with us by the government. So my argument's about being open and transparent so that we know we're getting these decisions as right as you can humanly get them. We're not going to get perfect information because this is these are difficult decisions. But for me, I don't think the government's done that job and didn't persuade me. That was the view of many of my colleagues. Others had different reasons for not supporting the government. I don't want to be in this position. I want to be in the position in January where I can support the government. And I hope the government learns from this vote this week and ups its game a bit ahead of that vote in January.
And when you put to the government that it should be more transparent, that you should see the data that was referred to in the Times, what do they say?
Well, I think it's two things. First, we have seen with the recent personnel changes, there's definitely been a tonal change in the government. The Prime Minister's letters to us, both the one that went to all MPs and the one that went to myself and Steve Baker and members of our group, was certainly, I think, quite collegiate in tone. But
you mean Dominic Cummings is no longer writing them?
You might say that, Andrew. I couldn't possibly comment. But the tone was good. But the substance, we didn't really see any shift in substance. But my argument is we need to see all the information out there. Let members of Parliament and the public look at these trade-offs. There are trade-offs here. They are difficult ones. But I think if you're open and honest with people, even if they don't like the choices you've made, if they can see how you've arrived at them, you've got a much better chance of taking people with you. And ultimately, dealing with this virus is about people's behaviour. It's about people's behaviour, social distancing, wearing face masks and how they behave. But even, coming back to James's point, it's about people's behaviour with the vaccine. It's about making sure we maximise the number of people that are willing to have the vaccine. It's about making sure that as we get the vaccine rolled out to the riskiest groups, those that are most likely to suffer from getting COVID, we can then reduce the restrictions on everybody else. So it's about people's behaviour, which means taking people with you. And that's why I think an open and transparent approach, a more open and transparent approach, is the right one to take.
But in strategic terms, the government would say, look, our second lockdown has managed to get on top of the second wave of COVID. We've now moved to a tier structure. We've got this vaccine coming. It starts to roll out next week. There are more on the way. We've had to loosen up for Christmas. That was basically responding to public demand or a feel that the public was going to do what it wanted anyway at Christmas. So they came up with some kind of rules that will inevitably lead to another spike in COVID cases. So we need to keep the tier system back in. But as this vaccine rolls out, we can move others to tier two, to tier one, and eventually get rid of it. We have a strategic way forward. Don't mess with it.
Well, it's very interesting, Andrew. You've set out what sounds like a very coherent narrative there. I haven't actually heard a single government minister lay out that coherent strategic narrative, actually, which is part of my argument. So we don't yet know how quickly we're going to be able to roll out the vaccine. So this is the difference. We keep hearing about Easter, from Easter, that we're going to be in a significantly more normal situation. But when you listen to some of the scientists, chief scientific advisor, for example, they're cautioning it may well take the best part of 6 months next year to get people sufficiently vaccinated. We don't know whether, how far down the list of the priority groups you've got to go before you can sensibly relax restrictions significantly. We don't yet know whether the vaccine actually stops people transmitting COVID or whether it just deals with stopping people getting severe symptoms or symptoms. So there's lots of questions we don't yet have the answer to. And I think that's why colleagues are nervous. I think if the government was a bit more open about its thinking and about the trade-offs, your trade-off discussion there about Christmas, the government hasn't actually said any of those things. It hasn't openly said it thinks people would have just done what they wanted anyway, so it's relaxing things for Christmas. And it hasn't said, because of that, it's having to keep things tougher. As James said, it's hinting it's going to relax things before Christmas. I agree with James. I don't think there's going to be any significant easing before Christmas. And I think if Christmas, the effects of Christmas are not good, and they're like we've seen in some other countries for Thanksgiving, for example, in Canada, you might see those restrictions have to stay in place through the whole of January. But I think part of the problem is here, if people, ministers levelled with us in the way you just have, I think lots of us would have been much more reassured and possibly wouldn't have had to vote against the government this week.
That's interesting. Maybe I should have applied for that job as government spokesman. But there was no chance of that, either of me applying.
I think that's probably right.
Or getting it. Putting process aside or even issues of transparency aside, are you clear in your own mind what policy change would you like to see from the government when it comes to lockdowns and tiers? What do you think it should do differently from what it's doing now?
Well, I think there's a really issue about lockdowns. I mean, one of the things we know from the first one is that the government's own analysis says that the impact of the lockdown and the recession it caused, if you take into account morbidity, so disease, not just mortality, people dying, the impact of that lockdown and the recession it caused is going to be bigger and more severe in terms of what are called quality-adjusted life years than actually the number of people that died from COVID in that period. So that's pretty important. Now, we've learned some lessons from that. So the second lockdown, you know, we didn't shut down the health service. We didn't clear out people from elective surgery. Actually, the health service did a fantastic job of keeping open for routine surgery and keeping people coming through the door. So that should have reduced the cost of that lockdown. But what I don't see is the trade-offs being made about what are the costs, the long-term costs, the economic costs. Because, you know, if we drive down the size of the economy and we throw people out of work, we know that has a health impact. We know it has an impact on chronic illnesses. And I just don't see any sense that we're balancing those things. There are no easy choices here, I accept that. But I want to know that government's properly balanced these issues and has properly weighed them up when it's reached its decisions. And to be honest, if I thought that had happened in government, if I thought that process had taken place, I would be much more likely to give the government the benefit of the doubt. But everything I read in the newspapers about how these decisions are being made and what I know from my own contacts suggests to me that that process isn't taking place, which is why I'm afraid I think Parliament's having to do the job that frankly should be taking place inside government.
How much concern and happiness is there on the Conservative backbenches about the government's overall performance in dealing with COVID?
Well, I'd say two things. I think, first of all, that there are a lot of people who are not very happy about the position we're in, but a lot of that's to do with the virus, not to do with the government. And I think there's a lot of people who think, including myself, who think that these have been incredibly difficult decisions and there are no easy answers. And yes, mistakes have been made, but frankly, no human being would have not made mistakes during this position. So I think there's still quite a lot of goodwill. And that's why I'm frustrated that the government hasn't been more open and tried to take MPs with it. I think if it was more open and tried to take MPs with it, shared information more, shared the decision-making process more, did what Michael Gove said, for example, I agree with him, MPs should take responsibility for these decisions. But we can't be expected to take responsibility if the government's not as open as it can be about sharing the information it has. I think MPs will be much more inclined to give the government the benefit of the doubt, to be perfectly honest. But I think to give the government the benefit of the doubt, I think it requires the government to be more open and transparent about how it's making these decisions.
Final question for you. Where does the rebellion go from here? What happens next?
Well, I very much hope, I mean, I will, you know, keep working with the government. I hope we can persuade the government to become more open and transparent between now and the end of January. James talked about the fact there needs to be another vote at the end of January. These regulations expire at the beginning of February, so there has to be another vote at the end of January. I hope we're in a position then where the government can set out its strategy in much the same way you did. We'll hopefully be some way down the process of being able to vaccinate the most vulnerable groups, and hopefully in a position at the end of January where what's being proposed for the next couple of months after that, we can see a significant easing of restrictions, get the economy starting to bounce back again, and obviously a significant number of people will have been protected from the virus by vaccination. And I think if government levelled with us and set out, even if there were more restrictions to come, but we could see a proper roadmap, I think colleagues will be in much better shape. And I'll do what I can to try and get us into that position. As I said, I'm not, as you mentioned, I was a former government chief whip. I'm not by inclination wanting to lead rebellions. That doesn't come naturally to me. I'd much rather be able to get the government in a position where I was able to support it. And that's what I will continue working to do in the weeks to come.
Mark Harper, thank you for joining us today. Thanks. On Spectator TV. It's been good to talk to you. Before we move on, I'd just like to remind you to subscribe to the Spectator's YouTube channel. It's free, and then you'll never miss a show of Spectator TV. Just hit the subscribe button in the bottom right corner. Now, in the time before COVID, that was BC, there were some who thought the SNP destined to fall from its pedestal, even if only on the basis that no governing party can remain so dominant for so long. And the SNP has been dominant for 13 years. But since the pandemic hit, Nicola Sturgeon's popularity has grown. And a new Ipsos Mori poll this week put support for Scottish independence at 56%. The Sturgeon paradox is our cover story this week in The Spectator. And I'm joined now by Emily Gray. She's Managing Director of Ipsos Mori Scotland. Emily, welcome to Spectator TV. Can you just go through the numbers for us first?
Absolutely. Thanks for the welcome, Andrew. So these are our latest Ipsos Mori poll findings on how people would vote in Scotland in next May's Scottish Parliament elections. So this chart shows the constituency vote, and the SNP are riding high. So more than twice as many people say that they would vote SNP as would vote Conservative. And when we look at the second list vote, then the story is similar. And that, as you say, it's really astonishing to see that level of support for a political party after 13 and a half years in power. When we look at the independence question, there is a clear lead for independence in our latest poll, and every poll that's been taken since the start of June has shown a lead for yes to independence. But it's worth saying that while that's built during the course of the pandemic, it's something that started earlier. When you look at the trend on Scottish independence, it has been, support for independence has been building over time, and we can talk about the factors behind that. I think part of it is also to do with Brexit. Obviously, Scotland voted, most Scots voted to remain. But we shouldn't forget that at the same time, independence is not the top issue on people's minds. So in some of Ipsos Mori's other polling, what we see is, of course, people are most worried about the coronavirus, but it's issues like economy, the NHS, education, that are, more at the forefront of people's minds. Independence actually comes quite far down the list of people's concerns, so always worth remembering that. Next slide, please. So we asked people across Scotland how much they trusted each of the main political parties to deal effectively with a whole range of key issues. And what we found was that the SNP was the most trusted party on every single one of those issues. And that includes issues like education down the bottom there, where the SNP's record has been the target of a lot of criticism. But that doesn't seem to be cutting through very much at the moment with the public across Scotland. Three in five of us still trust the SNP to manage education in schools. Next slide, please. And when you look at how the Conservatives are doing in Scotland, the picture is kind of flipped. So a third or fewer of Scots say that they trust the Scottish Conservatives to deal effectively with these issues. And that's even the case on the economy, which traditionally would have been perceived, as a relative strength of the Conservatives. So I think these numbers are quite difficult for Conservatives and for Unionists. And I do think they relate in part to Boris Johnson's real unpopularity in Scotland as well. Next slide, please. But of course, all of this is very, very far from being settled. And we were keen to look at people's strength of opinion on staying part of the UK or independence. And what we found there is around a quarter of people still haven't completely made up their minds. So you have, and so don't have a completely definitive position on whether Scotland should stay part of the UK or come out. And I think that's really important to remember. And it's that middle ground, I think, that shows us that both the yes campaigners cannot be complacent, even though these numbers look very good for the SNP and for independence. And also that, it also, I think, gives a glimmer of hope for unionists as well. As I say, this is very far from settled.
Thank you for that. They're fascinating figures. Emily, how comfortable are you with the question, should Scotland be an independent country? Because, of course, it leaves a multitude of things unanswered. Independent outside Europe, inside Europe, independent with what currency? Its own currency, sterling, the euro, and so on. And during the COVID crisis, many Scots might have concluded that Scotland effectively is an independent country already, watching Nicola Sturgeon on BBC Scotland every day.
Well, it's true that devolution has been, I think, more visible. Devolution in action has been more visible than ever before in Scotland over the course of the pandemic. You see decisions taken in Scotland that are affecting people's day-to-day lives. And I think that has been quite powerful in terms of public opinion. But, you know, of course, this is the question that was asked back in 2014. And so, as you would expect, continue polling on that. But when you look at devolution more widely, I think what it shows you on public opinion is that most Scots are in favour of devolution. So we can look at the different forms of that. We also looked quite recently at what people felt were the most compelling arguments, either for independence or for staying part of the UK. And, you know, of course, the economic risks of independence still play out strongly as a reason for staying part of the UK. But I think there's also a question of, you know, where is the positive case for the union and who makes that? And, you know, so, for example, one thing we found is that the argument that across the UK we have more in common than divides us actually can be quite powerful for people. But it's not an argument that I think Scots are really hearing from at the moment.
No, so there's a lot of messages for the unionist side in your poll to basically get their act together and get a coherent message. I mean, the Scottish National Party has a coherent message. You might not like it, but we're in no doubt what it stands for and what it wants to do in terms of the general vision. It is interesting, though, when you look at your slide on the SNP being trusted on education and in health. Because when you look at the figures, take the handling of COVID, Nicola Sturgeon has certainly not done it better than Boris Johnson and may even have done it worse, as Andrew Marr put to her on the BBC the weekend, on a whole range of educational parameters, metrics. The SNP has not delivered on the famous attainment gap in particular. It hasn't narrowed the performance between the poorest kids and the most affluent kids. Health, we know the classic examples of the hospital in Glasgow where people have been picking up terrible diseases and even dying, and the Children's Hospital in Edinburgh hasn't, I don't think, it's still not even opened yet. But none of that seems to matter when people reply to your poll. Is that because the media in Scotland isn't telling them anything about this?
I think it's as much to do with leadership and communication during the pandemic. So we know that Nicola Sturgeon's ratings have stayed pretty high over the course of the pandemic, whereas that's not been the case for Boris Johnson in Scotland or across the UK. But I think it's also around that more cautious approach to managing the pandemic that the Scottish Government has taken. And I think that's really chimed with how people have been feeling day to day in Scotland, because people have been scared, people have been anxious, and that kind of more cautious approach, you know, rightly or wrongly, has, you know, does seem to have cut through.
Have you done any questioning, any polling on would you like to be independent but rejoin the EU and take the euro?
It's an interesting question of that. And I think the thing is that it will be such a high, it'd be a very hypothetical situation at the moment. But what we did look at in our latest poll was how people were feeling about Brexit. And, you know, as you would expect, you know, a majority of Scots were feeling pessimistic about the likely impacts of Brexit.
But because they voted 2-1 for Remain.
Yeah.
Though it's been a slow burn, that issue. I mean, I think Nicola Sturgeon in the early days after 2016 was surprised that the Brexit referendum, in which Scottish votes were basically overwhelmed, or Scottish Remain votes were overwhelmed by English Leave votes, I think she was surprised it didn't move the dial so much in her direction. But the evidence now is it's been a slow burn, and it perhaps is moving in her direction now, that the Brexit referendum has helped her case.
And to be clear, this latest shift to towards support for independence over the last year or so is not about Brexit. So its support has increased both among leavers and remainers to pretty much the same extent. It's down to other factors. I think the pandemic has been a big factor in that.
Emily Gray, Managing Director of Ipsos Mori Scotland, thank you for joining us and sharing these poll numbers with us. Fascinating stuff. James, let me come straight to you. The government, the unionists, they clearly know they've got a big problem on their hands. Do they have any idea what to do about it?
So I think they have some idea. So I think it is as close as anything is to being a certainty in contemporary politics that the SNP will win a majority at the Holyrood elections next May, and that Nicola Sturgeon will then demand a second independence referendum. I mean, the pressure she will come under from within her own party means that demand will come early, so 2021 or very early in 2022. I think in those circumstances, the UK government will be able to push it back by saying, look, both governments right now should be concentrating on the recovery from coronavirus, dealing with the economic and social scars that it has left behind, rather than an independence referendum. Talking to people who've done focus groups of undecided voters up there, that argument seems to land fairly well with that crucial group of voters. The more difficult question is, how do you keep saying this? How valid is that as an argument in 2023 or 2024? And I think there, the UK government is going to have to do something that is not something that excites Tories or excites Boris Johnson. I think it is going to have to look at the whole constitutional framework of the UK. And I think it's going to say, look, I think it's basically got to buy time. It's got to say, look, let's have a constitutional convention. Let's discuss what we're going to do about extra powers for these new mayors in England. You know, all of these kind of issues. Because I think that this support for independence to a quite remarkable extent is built on the back of Nicola Sturgeon's popularity. And so I think, like Mr. McCorbett, it is worth for the unionist side just waiting for something to turn up. Whether it be something that damages Nicola Sturgeon's popularity, or the tolls of office taking part, or issues in our own party. I mean, a kind of undercovered story, I think, is the fact that in the recent SNP internal party elections, rivals of Nicola Sturgeon ascended to some quite key positions. We haven't seen the whole Alex Salmond issue play out with the inquiry at Holyrood. So I think that for the unionist side should be aiming to buy time, because it is undoubtedly Nicola Sturgeon herself personally that is driving the support for independence. I mean, I think a very good compliment to Emily's work is some focus groups done by the group called These Islands. And it is quite remarkable, because what it illustrates is that when you say, talk to voters about undecided voters about the currency question that you rightly raised, Andrew, these voters say, well, things like, well, kind of, well, Nicola would have thought about that. And so I think you've got to try and buy some time, because if you had a referendum with Nicola Sturgeon in her current pomp, I think it would be very, very, very hard sledding for the unionist side.
Katie, the Tories have a problem in dealing with this, which I think is probably insoluble for them unless they do something very dramatic. And that is that all the polling and anecdotal evidence suggests that going into bat for the union, to save the union when your leader is Boris Johnson, is a major disadvantage for you. He just does not poll well north of the border.
I think that is a well-held view by many, particularly Scottish Tory MPs. I've had a Scottish Tory MP make the point to me that you can't have a referendum while Boris Johnson is Prime Minister. They put it quite bluntly. They think you have to wait for one of either Nicola Sturgeon or Boris Johnson to change, ideally both. They think that would probably help the unionist side. And I think there is probably a more widely held view I've heard, which is ultimately there are lots of Tory MPs who would rather push the referendum until there's a Labour government. Now, that's not because they want it to necessarily be Labour's problem. I'm sure there's a little bit of that. No one wants to be the Prime Minister who potentially loses Scotland. But I think it's because there is a sense that there will be a better chance of, you know, winning that vote from the unionists if you had a Labour Prime Minister rather than a Tory one. I think there are Tory politicians that are seen to poll well in Scotland. It's interesting that some of the figures involved in advising the government on this question, Rishi Sunak is someone who I think Scottish Tory MPs are very keen to be seen visiting them. I think there's less keenness for Boris Johnson, but there are a few cabinet ministers that I think do play well there. So I don't think that, you know, there's a blocker of anyone Tory, but definitely, as you say, there is a Boris Johnson problem, and I think that's become more acute.
James, final point to you. We know that Scotland voting to remain in the EU, England voting against, was it kind of changed the constitutional nature. That was a big change compared to 2014, indeed, when the union has said the only way to ensure that Scotland stays in the EU is to vote for the union. So that's changed. But I wonder if it's changed in another way. The British establishment, and it comes through in the cover story of The Spectator, which I thought was incredibly defeatist in its approach to the union, which is that a lot of Remainers, including the author of The Spectator cover piece, a lot of Remainers seem to have think you know, well, we were for the union. We supported the union. We backed it in 2014. But you made such a stupid mistake, you, the United Kingdom, in voting to leave the EU. It would almost serve you right if Scotland was to leave the United Kingdom. So their hearts aren't in it anymore. And that's split off a chunk of the British establishment from the unionist, an enthusiastic unionist side, James.
Yeah, look, I mean, the one, it would be very hard to claim that Brexit had been a success if it led directly or indirectly to the breakup of the 300-year union between England, Wales and Scotland. I mean that would clearly mark it out as a failure. I think that is a problem. I think there is an interesting question here, which is, you know, if there is a Brexit deal, which I think it's far from certain, but I think it looks more likely than it has done for a little while, and more likely than not at the moment. You know, does the combination of a Brexit deal and if this Oxford vaccine is approved, so you have a kind of a British vaccine and the British state successfully manages to roll it out, does that begin to change some of those arguments? I also think one of the great skills of the Scottish National Party has been to suggest that it is somehow a more sophisticated form of nationalism, a kind of social democrat nationalism, rather than the kind of nationalism that establishment figures are uncomfortable with. But I think you do see that mask slips occasionally. I thought it was very telling that the Westminster leader of the SNP, Ian Blackford, tweeted at a photographer who just sent a perfectly beautiful picture of the Scottish night sky saying, "You come from southern England, how are you taking this photograph in Scotland given the coronavirus regulations?" This photographer, it turned up, had moved up to Scotland and was resident, you know, there in complete compliance with the regulations. So sometimes that mask does slip. And I think there is an interesting question, which is, you know, when this question gets real, when this isn't a way of saying, well, Brexit wasn't a good idea, or a way of kind of tweaking a Westminster government's tail, when it really is the question, are you going to break up these bonds that have lasted for 300 years? Are you going to break up not only an economic, military and political union, but also a social union? I mean, we're talking about the Christmas coronavirus restrictions. One of the reasons why those had to be done on a four-nation approach, all of the UK moving in the same way, was because so many people visit families in other parts of the UK at Christmas. Are you really going to render all of that asunder? I wonder whether at that point people pull back. And in 2014, what you saw in the campaign was essentially undecided voters, or lightly decided voters, as you might put it, move from no to yes during the campaign. I wonder whether, come the campaign, and this will obviously need to happen for the union to survive, you'll see some of those votes, some of the undecided or lightly decided voters, move back to the unionist side when the full reality of independence, the currency question, all of these issues, EU membership, begin to really, really register.
No, I think all of these are points that have yet really to come into play, James, in the argument, which is why I think if you're a unionist, defeatism, although you have a mountain to climb now, it's going to be much, much tougher, but I don't think defeatism is merited. 8 billion of oil revenues in 2014 solved all sorts of problems for the SNP. That's not there anymore. A Scotland outside the UK, but a member of the EU, with England outside the EU, does mean some kind of border between Scotland and England. That wasn't really an issue in 2014 either. And the currency question remains seriously unresolved too, and that matters for the older age group as well. So there are many things still to talk about, and we shall see how it goes on. James, Katie, Emily, I know you're very busy. I'm going to let you go now and move on to our final third section of the day here on Spectator TV. But before I do, just one more reminder to subscribe to the Spectator's YouTube channel. It's free. Then you'll never miss a new episode of Spectator TV, because you always get reminded that there's one has just hit YouTube. And you can do so by subscribing. Hit the subscribe button in the bottom right corner of the screen. Now, in May, a black man called George Floyd was killed at the hands, or should I say knee, of American police. His death triggered months of protests, sometimes violent and destructive, many also peaceful, and gave renewed impetus to the Black Lives Matter movement. As ever, the UK imported the culture wars of America. It wasn't long before statues here were being toppled and calls to defund the police were levied at the Met, though they didn't get very far in mainstream politics. Now, underlying much of these activists' worldview is so-called critical race theory. Now, you might be familiar with some of it already, that Western institutions are inherently racist, that white people are structurally privileged, that the British syllabus in schools and universities is colonized. It's a controversial theory. Many have criticized it. It's popular in many academic circles and among some activists. But is it right? Is it a theory of substance? Who better to ask than Trevor Phillips, former chair of the Equality and Human Rights Commission, one of the authors of the 2010 Equality Act. Trevor Phillips, thank you for joining us here on Spectator TV. Just mark my card. Give us a better summary of critical race theory than the one I just gave.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you for inviting me. And I wouldn't even dream of trying to better your summary. It was pretty damn good. I think the way that I look at it is this. As you will undoubtedly know, I'm pretty much a skeptic of critical race theory. And I'm a skeptic for this reason. If I were a white nationalist who wanted to discredit the progressive anti-racist movement, I would invent critical race theory. Why? Number one, it says to white people, you were born with original sin, and there is absolutely no way that you will ever shed that sin. So give up already. You are just racist, and basically the only thing you can ever do, in one of the Bibles of critical race theory, Robin DiAngelo's book, White Fragility, she says, the only thing white people can do is be a bit less white, by which she means a bit less racist. Secondly, the other reason, second reason I dislike it is that it's antithetical to scholarship. I mean, one of the key aspects of the text of critical race theory is that it has to have no data. Data is an obsession with words, I think is the expression, are said to be characteristics of white supremacy. So actually, what critical race theory is based on is narrative, anecdote, what happened to me and my feelings. And actually, all of this adds up to two things. One is distraction from real issues, like pay gaps and so on. And secondly, an obsession with individual feelings, none of which will change a single thing for people of colour on either side of the Atlantic.
Let me unroll some of these things. But before I do, Trevor, one of the things that strikes me about particularly its depiction of whites, that they are just irredeemably racist and there's not really much they can do about it except to the margins. It reminds me of a Calvinistic predestination. It doesn't matter how you behave in this world, it's predestined whether you get into heaven or not. It doesn't really matter. And there's a bit of that about critical race theory.
Well, look, I mean, let's be clear. It's a scam. It is straightforwardly a scam. You only have to go back to reading Tom Wolfe's Mau Mauing the Flat Catchers, in which he describes the way the Black Panthers essentially took down Leonard Bernstein and white New York society and played on their guilt in order to raise money for the Panthers. By the way, I'm full of admiration for their enterprise, but this has absolutely nothing to do with improving the situation for people of colour. And here is the other thing which I think is particularly pernicious. It makes the issues of race equality entirely about white people. It is entirely about what white people do, entirely about what white people feel. People like me simply become pawns or bystanders who sit here begging you, Andrew, please be nicer to us. That's the real problem with critical race theory. It's great for the academics who sell books and can go around guilt-tripping white people, but for most people of colour, no difference whatsoever.
Now, I take your point because it does kind of, everything is benchmarked against white. And it doesn't deal with all the huge inequalities we see in Britain's ethnic communities, say between a kid from China, Anglo-Chinese parents, and a kid from Anglo-Bangladeshi parents. None of that seems to to matter at all. One of the things, I mean, I'm not qualified to say whether it's right or wrong, but one of the things that depresses me about critical race theory is that it seems to pay no regard to the progress that has been made in a country like Britain. Now, we know we have still a long way to go, and there's a lot more we need to do for opportunities and deal with racism where it still exists, and no one can deny that it doesn't. But I was brought up in the 50s and 60s. You were brought up not that much later. We know how much this country has changed, and changed for the better. And it seems to me if you say nothing's really changed, then you just kind of give up. Whereas if you think, actually, we've done quite well, we could have done better, we've done quite well, let's do better now, that's a message of hope.
Yeah. By the way, just if I can just make one point to you, Andrew, and also to your listeners. You began that question by slightly apologising for being white. You don't have to, mate. Honestly, it's cool. I'm chilled with it. Of course, you're never therefore going to be as handsome or as strong or run as fast as me, but that's your problem.
I've learned to live with that for quite a while now.
Yeah, you don't have to apologise for it. But I think your point is a very important one. And from the point of view of somebody like me, my family, I'm the 10th of 10 children, my parents and my oldest brother, my brothers, who were very active in the anti-racist movement in the 50s and 60s, it's kind of disrespectful to them. Every time I hear one of these people say, oh, nothing has changed, they literally have no idea. My brother ran home from school every day being chased by teddy boys. You know, my eldest brother ended up in Wakefield prison for his anti-racist activities. So I think it's utterly disrespectful to our parents and our forebears to be going around saying, oh, nothing has changed. And by the way, this is another facet of the way that the whole Black Lives Matter movement has essentially been taken over by white people, because they feel it's okay to disrespect us. It's okay for them to go on Twitter and call me a coon, because that Black Lives Matter gives them license to it. But there's another very important point which I think ought to be made here. The problem with a lot of the Black Lives Matter propaganda is it does not recognise that Britain is a very different place to the United States. And here is one extremely, I think, significant factor. In this country, they're getting on now for 1 million people who have both white and black parents or grandparents. That has not happened voluntarily anywhere in the world. South Africa has mixed race, Brazil has mixed race populations, the United States, but they're all out of coercion and slavery. This is the only country in which a population of that kind, of that size, has emerged since the war. And somehow saying to those people, actually, your mum is just a racist because of what she is, it's sickening.
No, intermarriage has been, hasn't that been a great British success story?
Well, we can talk about the details of it, but the fact is it's a particular thing about that's happened in Britain that we ought to recognise. We don't know, by the way, what this group of people are really going to emerge like and what they're going to be like. I don't know what it feels like to have two different heritages in my background. My children do, and I think that will make them very different people to me, but we don't yet quite know what that represents.
I would think it will probably make them 21st century.
That's
the way it's going. I wonder if there isn't an even bigger agenda behind the not so much Black Lives Matter, but of this whole critical race theory. Because it does seem almost to try to be aiming daggers at the very heart of our being and our existence and our history. So Britain, it will always be irredeemably bad because of the British Empire. It's just something you can never shake off, end of. And if you look at the New York Times, the 1619 project, which was inspired by a lot of critical race theory, they picked 1619, a very important date. Many people did not know enough about it. It was the first slaves arrived in the United States. It is a critical date. It is the original sin of the United States. But it then goes on to argue that the purpose of the American Revolution in 1776 was not to free America from a colonial yoke and become an independent, self-governing country, it was because the slave owners were frightened that Britain was going to abolish slavery. So they had to break from the British to preserve slavery. Now, as someone who knows quite a lot about American history, I can tell you that's complete nonsense.
Yes,
bar
true.
A couple of slave owners in the South who might have seen it that way. And actually, Britain's anti-slavery credentials were nowhere near strong enough in 1776 to be able to conclude that. But if you see what they've done, the very foundation of the United States is not built on freedom anymore or on becoming an independent country. It's built to preserve slavery. That goes to the very roots of the country.
Yes, and this relates to two points that I've made. One is the complete lack of scholarship. I mean, it's just, as you say, it's complete drivel. And actually, their understanding of the slave experience is utterly deficient. I mean, for example, one of the things that nobody really talks about is the fact that when we talk about slavery today in this country, and to some extent in the United States, what people are reflecting and thinking about is slavery in the Caribbean rather than the United States. Now, this is a rather kind of geeky point, but most American slavery was cotton and tobacco slavery, small farms, almost no American plant farms were huge, you know, like you see in Gone with the Wind with 1,000 slaves and so on. I think probably there are fewer than, out of 45,000, there are fewer than a few hundred that had more than 100 slaves. Whereas in the Caribbean, these were huge factories with thousands of slaves. So their understanding, and this is important because actually what is true about the United States, and I think the Black Lives Matter movement has missed a trick in this, is that the terror for African Americans occurred after the abolition of slavery. That is when the KKK emerged. That is when the lynchings happened. And what we're seeing now with the police is an inheritor of that rather than slavery. And I think they've just missed a trick, actually, because they haven't understood the story. But more, I guess more importantly than that, politically, we think of Black Lives Matter as, or we talk about it as though it's an inheritor of the Martin Luther King tradition. It isn't. We should think of Black Lives Matter much more like Extinction Rebellion, because a basic proposition is, like with Extinction Rebellion, you can't have a green world under capitalism. The BLM line is you cannot have an anti-racist society under capitalism. Never mind the fact that in Cuba there's still never been much of a black presence in the leadership after how many years a slave of socialism. Ditto, you know, my brother got beaten up in Moscow long before that was happening here. I mean, they want, they're being used essentially as a front for people who want to overthrow things as they are. And in a way, that's one of the reasons that I slightly resent it, that actually these guys don't really care very much about whether black people are advanced or not. What they want is for us to be a battering ram for their desire to change society. I'm not against that, you know. I'm a lefty, but do it honestly. Don't use us as a pawn.
I certainly think it's true that Martin Luther King would not have been a supporter of critical race theory. I wonder, though, I just finish up on this point, slightly left field. I wonder if Malcolm X would have been a supporter of critical race theory.
Well, funnily enough, I reviewed a new biography.
There's a new biography out, a very interesting biography.
It's a really interesting biography. I think that Malcolm X would not have been a supporter of Black Lives Matter because he wouldn't have liked the indiscipline of the movement. I mean, he believed strongly in proper discipline. I think he would have seen some sort of commonalities with critical race theory in the middle part of his career, because his view was you couldn't trust whites and therefore we needed to be separate from them. And in that sense, the notion that, you know, whites carry this original sin, he called you know, people quote by any means necessary all the time. They don't quote him saying whites are blue-eyed devils very much. He believed all of that. However, of course, after he had gone to Mecca, had Hajj, gone round with the Seven Hills with hundreds of thousands of people of all background. He wrote about this incredibly movingly. He dropped the whole idea that whites are intrinsically bad, you can't mix with them, all that kind of stuff. So I think at the end of his life, short life, unfortunately, he would have been really pretty hostile to critical race theory. And also he would have recognised them for chances.
Yes, exactly. And I think it was a pity it was a short life, because he was an evolving person and he had still so much more to contribute. Trevor, we could talk all day about this. It's been a joy to have you on TV. Come back and see us again. It's always great to listen to you. Trevor Phillips there.
Thank you very much.
So thanks to all of our guests today, and once again to our very special sponsor, Charles Stanley. Charles Stanley is one of the UK's oldest and leading wealth management firms. Indeed, it's one of the oldest firms on the London Stock Exchange. As always, please send us your thoughts to spectatortv@spectator.co.uk. We want to do better. We know we can. We're interested in what you have to say. A lot of your comments have been very constructive. And we hope that you'll join us again next Thursday for another The Week in 60 Minutes. Until then, goodbye.